Good evening, good day, everybody, and welcome back to the Indian Interest podcast. The Indian Interest is back. Episode 27 is live, and I hope you're all doing extremely well. Let us see, as always, before we begin, who all is there on the live chat. I can see Priyanshi, Nightshed Gaming, Vladimir Zelensky, Aditya, Cheers Feminist, Debosman, Azmenor, Niharika, Karan, Liger, Anant Dev Tyagi, Peshwa Baji Rao, Spartan Bhagwa, The World Teacher, Aryaman Agarwal, Stuart, Ronald McGujar, Kamlesh Singh, Shekhar Shubhadeep, Krishan 63, Prapti, Midnight Stalker, Kamlesh, Prag Kumar, Yash Raj, Swapna Neel, Park Jimin, Jeet Roy Chaudhary, Celestial Dust, Sumedha, Saket, Harsh Jain, Shushrut, Dhruv Kumar, DK, Barno Pramanik, Captain Anonymous, Close Your Eyes and Feel the Music, Baba Baba, Yogesh Sharma, G Sai Siddharth, Sudhir, Anmol Sanoli, P Bharatam, Darpan Singh, Radha Krishna, Sankalp Abhinav, Atharv, Darshan, Vishnu, Ishan Parlevar, Amisha, XKCD Destroyer, G Sai Siddharth, and everybody else. Good evening, good day, all of you. I hope you're all doing fantastically well. So, bonsoir, Mr. Joseph Stalin, and so on. Yeah. So, with that said, let's get into the heart of the matter. So, today we're going to discuss a number of things, but let us begin with the main topic. So, what's happening in Manipur? Something is happening in Manipur. Manipur is in turmoil. And I have stated this many times in the past, especially on the Indian Interest podcast, that we can expect a lot of foreign interference in India in the run-up to the 2024 general elections, right? And we are starting to witness, you know, signs and symptoms and manifestations of this. So let's understand what the story of Manipur is. Now, this is an ongoing matter. So I'm not going to go into very specific details because it's still a sensitive issue. It's something that's happening as we speak. But let's examine Manipur. Let's talk about the history of Manipur and try and understand what's happening there. So we know where India is. Hopefully we all do. So in the far east of India, we have the state of Manipur. As we can see here, this is the state of Manipur, which is south of Nagaland, north of Mizoram, and east of Burma, and west of Assam. That's the state of Manipur, right? Now, to understand what this entire matter is, we have to go back a little bit in history. First of all, we have to understand that Manipur, the kingdom of Manipur, was historically much larger than the present-day state of Manipur. The kingdom of Manipur was way larger. It even went all the way up to Yunnan province of present-day China. Okay, it included large parts of what is now Myanmar. It included much of what is now called Nagaland. Historically, it's been like that. Today, we have a whole different situation. Okay, so Manipur state was much larger in the past. Now, the Burmese occupied Manipur between 1819 and 1826. That is the 7 years of devastation in which they totally devastated Manipur. And this Burmese occupation of Manipur ended with the defeat of the Burmese in the First Anglo-Burmese War. So this defeat happened in 1826, 25 or 26. Look it up if you are interested, the exact date. So the Burmese were defeated by the British in the First Anglo-Burmese War, and then the Burmese were made to sign a treaty, the Treaty of Yandabo, in which a large Burmese-held territories were given away, were ceded to the British, including the Kingdom of Manipur. So the Manipur, Manipur then became a vassal state of Britain. And the British gave away Manipur's, not gave away, but leased Manipur's Kabo Valley to the Burmese. And that's something that was, given away by Mr. Nehru after independence as if it was his own property. So at the end of the First Anglo-Burmese War, Manipur came back. Well, Manipur became quasi-independent. It became a British vassal state. And Burma was totally crippled at the end of the First Anglo-Burmese War. And Burma eventually was annexed by the British by 1885, I think. Okay. So then the British became the overlords of Manipur. They allowed the Manipuris to have their own king and their own system, but the British were the overlords. And eventually the British interference in Manipur became so much that the Manipuris rebelled and tried to fight for the independence in 1891, the Anglo-Manipuri War, which was unfortunately, which ended in a British victory. They hanged the crown prince and the great general, Thangal general, in the middle of Imphal city, and they exiled the king of Manipur to Kalapani, the Andamans, and we don't know what happened to the king of Manipur. And they installed a puppet king of Manipur in his place. So this was the Anglo-Manipuri War, 1891. Now, the Manipuris were extremely fierce warriors, and they really worried the British. So what the British did is they started changing the demography and the demographic makeup of Manipur. They started settling what they called, in their words, not my words, in the British words, Burmese undesirables in Manipur. So certain tribal groups who were not very popular, let's say, in Burma, the British started settling them in southern and eastern Manipur. And the British refer to these tribal groups extremely scathingly in their writings. Okay, the British are extremely disparaging about them. The British claim that these people are not civilized. They're very primitive, backward, savage, whatever. That's what the British wrote about them. These are not my words, British words. Okay, so the British started changing the demography of Manipur. It's kind of similar to what the British did in Sri Lanka. They started settling people who did not historically have a presence in Sri Lanka, and that's what has led to the entire conflict in Sri Lanka, which Sri Lanka went through for decades in the 20th century and which ended in the first decade of the 21st century. So the same kind of thing the British did in Manipur. What the British also did, see, the natives of Manipur, they are called the Meitei people, M-E-I-T-E-I, Meitei people. They are Hindus, okay? So the British, what they did was that they confined the Meiteis to the Imphal Valley only. If you see Manipur, let's look here. Can you see this? So over here, you have the red part and the orange part. The red part is outer Manipur. The orange part is inner Manipur. That's the Imphal Valley. So the people of Manipur, the Meiteis, were confined by the British only to Imphal Valley. Okay? And the tribal groups were allowed to settle all across the rest of Manipur, including these Burmese settlers. Okay? So in the 1896 British reports of Manipur, authored by Johnston, it is clear that the Burmese settlers were at that time less than 4% of the population. Now, these Burmese settlers who the British brought in, these tribal groups, etc., they were all converts to Christianity. These days, some of them even claim to be Jews, and they even get settled in Israel, and they are treated very badly by the Israelis. Yeah, So at that time, in 1896, these people were less than 4% of the population. And then you also have, this is the situation, right? The Hindus, the Meiteis, the actual people of Manipur were confined to a very small portion of the state. And others were settled in other parts. The Nagas, I mean, the Tangkhuls and the other hill tribes of Manipur, the Konyaks, the Tangkhul, the Ao, the Mao, the Rengma, the Angmai, Lotha, Rongmai, Liangmai, all these various tribal groups, they were then renamed as the Nagas. And they are obviously the sons and daughters of the soil, so it's not like they are outsiders. Now, if you look at the census of Manipur, 1901, or if you see the census of India, 1911, in which you have mentions of Manipur, which comes under Assam at that time, you will see that these outsiders who were settled by the British were a very small percentage of the population. So the British instituted this system of apartheid against the Hindus in Manipur. They confined them to a very small part of the of their kingdom, of their state. In 1901, the Hindus were 96% of Manipur. And in the 2011 census, the Hindus are only 41%. That's 2011. Today, I wonder what the percentage is. So the situation is that the Meitei people of Manipur, the Hindus, they face apartheid. And that apartheid was instituted by the British, but it was continued afterwards by the government of India. And you have this thing over here, the Manipur Hill Areas District Councils Act, which if you read it, it's all legal language, legalese, and it doesn't explicitly confine the Meitei people to Imphal Valley. But if you study it in detail, it becomes clear that the Meiteis have no right to buy land outside the Imphal Valley. Yes. So, and outsiders have the right to buy land in Imphal Valley. I mean, the tribal people. So what's happening is that today the situation is that the Hindus of Manipur, they are in possession of less than 5% of the land of the state. And this is something that's, you know, it's even worse than Article 370 of Kashmir. So that's the situation right now in Manipur, okay? So the Hindus, the Meiteis, they are not ST or SC, Scheduled Tribe or Scheduled Caste. They come under the general category. And the Nagas, who are also indigenous to Manipur and this region, these tribal groups are categorized as ST, Scheduled Tribes, and the descendants of the and the various Burmese settlers are also now considered to be ST, Scheduled Tribes. And these Burmese origin people, they are now in possession of much of South Manipur and East Manipur, including the strategically important town of Moray. Where is Moray? Moray is along the India-Burma border. Here it is, Moray. Extremely important, strategically important town. So that's the situation right now. So essentially, the Hindus are in possession of less than 5% of the land. They don't have the right to buy land outside of Imphal Valley. But the non-Hindus have the right to buy land anywhere. So that is the situation that the Hindus of Manipur are facing. Now, so what happened is that in April this year, the Manipur High Court directed the state of Manipur to consider the inclusion of the Hindus, the Meitei community, in the Scheduled Tribes list. So they directed the state government to recommend to the Union Government of India the inclusion of the Meitei community in the Scheduled Tribes list. And this decade, this demand has existed for many decades, and successive governments have dragged their feet about this for whatever reason. Manipur government had neglected to act on this, as we can see over here. So once the Manipur High Court gave this order, essentially all hell broke loose. Appeal filed in Supreme Court against the High Court order at the center of tensions. So the people who are benefiting from the ST status, they don't want the Manipuri Hindus to get that. So all hell has broken loose, and this tremendous, and I will not report about what's really happening. Churachandpur is a region in Manipur, it's a city in Manipur where much of the violence has happened. Essentially, what's happening is that whatever remaining Hindu populations exist outside of the Imphal Valley are all being evicted, and essentially it's ethnic cleansing. It's kind of like Direct Action Day. 1944, kind of like that. Okay, so the Meitei people, the Hindus, are increasingly now confined to a very small portion of Manipur, the Imphal Valley, and only some parts of Imphal Valley too. So that is the situation that we are seeing, and that's essentially the situation that currently exists. Now, the Indian government has sent reinforcements, army and all that, and hopefully things are in a better situation right now. Law and order has been restored or not, I'm not sure, but that is what has been happening in Manipur. Now the real question we have to ask ourselves is, why does this always happen in Manipur? If you, I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but if you look at the news reports of the past 20 years, Manipur is repeatedly at the center of all kinds of tensions. So we have a number of states in the Northeast. Look at Manipur's neighboring states, Nagaland, Mizoram, etc. How come nothing ever happens there? These Burmese settlers, okay, these Burmese tribal groups who have settled in Manipur, why have they not tried to settle in Nagaland? Why, and some of them are coming through Mizoram also, but why they're not settling in Mizoram? What's happening, right? So this, the situation is very clear. Manipur is the last bastion of Hinduism. And the objective is to eradicate all traces of Hinduism from the far east of India, which is also called the northeast of India. So we have to understand that in 2017, the BJP came to power in Manipur. Until that time, Manipur was in terrible shape. All, you know, it was under this insurgency for decades because of stepmotherly treatment by the central government and all kinds of corruption and all kinds of criminal activities and insurgency and separatism, all that. So after 2017, there's been a drastic change in Manipur. The insurgency has essentially been, you know, decimated. No more insurgency. Businesses have been booming in Manipur. There has been a lot of prosperity after 2017. Before 2017, as soon as, you know, it was evening, there was a de facto curfew all across Manipur. Today you have nightlife in Manipur. So Manipur has genuinely become totally transformed after 2017. It's becoming more and more prosperous. People are operating businesses. So that's why Manipur seems to have been targeted. That Manipur should not become, you know, go back to normalcy. Manipur should not be prosperous. And essentially, it's about Manipur being the last bastion of Hinduism in the whole of Northeast, in the whole of the Northeast. So this is part of essentially a larger plan to destabilize India before the 2024 elections, general elections. I have spoken about this many times before. It's about destabilizing India. It's about creating problems throughout the nation for the central government. It's about making the Prime Minister of India look weak so that they can effect a regime change operation in India, hopefully have a weak government come to power. So that's the kind of thing that is happening. Now let's look into this in more detail. There is something called the Joshua Project. What is the Joshua Project? The Joshua Project is a Christian organization based in Colorado Springs, United States, which seeks to coordinate the work of missionary organizations to track the ethnic groups of the world with the fewest followers of evangelical Christianity, etc. So it's all about converting the world to Christianity. So let's take a look at their website about Manipur. First of all, they have this horrible distorted map of India, okay? And they have an entire page dedicated to the Meitei people, the Manipuri Hindus. And what does it say about them? The Meitei are very resistant to change, particularly in the area of religion. Outsiders trying to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ are not well received, and individuals may resist the gospel for fear that whatever. Much work needs to be done to make them aware of their need for Christ. Okay, so that's what it is about. The Meitei people need the chance to allow Jesus Christ to bless them far above what they can ever imagine, and so on. And there is this entire page about the Meitei people, their tradition, their culture, and all that. Prayer points from Joshua Project. Ask the Lord of the harvest to send Christian laborers to live and work among the Manipuri. Ask the Holy Spirit to grant wisdom and favor to missions agencies currently focusing on the Manipuri. So there is a significant focus on these people. Pray for open doors for the Jesus film to be shown to the Manipuri. Ask God to raise up prayer teams who will begin breaking up the soil through worship and intercession and so on and so forth. For neighboring Christian tribes to love the Meiteis and reach out to them. So there is a concerted effort to eradicate Hinduism and the original religion, original culture from the northeast of India. Okay. So that is what it's about. So this organization is based in the United States. All right. And they have an outreach across the world, but especially focused on what we call Northeast India, which is the far east of India. And this region has been almost totally Christianized. Now, I have nothing against the Christian religion or any such thing, but I am against artificial re-engineering of demographics, which is something that's happened in the past, you know, in the 20th century and beyond. So the people of Nagaland have totally lost their culture. Totally, it's been totally eradicated. Their wonderful, beautiful culture, which they had, their ancestors had, it's gone, right? And the similar thing has happened in Mizoram. Now they want this to happen in Manipur. Okay, so Manipur is the last bastion of Hinduism, and that's why they are focusing on Manipur only. None of these problems happen in any of the other neighboring states. It's always Manipur, Manipur, Manipur. So we are seeing a resurgence of this. Manipur was becoming prosperous. Manipur was becoming stable. So that's why it's time to destabilize Manipur. And it's a great opportunity to do this before the 2024 elections, to make the government look weak, to create all kinds of headaches and problems and tensions for the central government. And this is something that's part of a larger scheme. You will find all kinds of other problems happening right now in coordination. For instance, we have this issue. We are seeing an increase, an uptick in the frequency of terrorist activity in Jammu and Kashmir. We are seeing an increase in the frequency of attacks against the Indian Army in Jammu and Kashmir. You know, that's something that's happening in the past month or two, right? In recent times, we are seeing an uptick in protests against the governments, manufactured protests with professional protesters. I think there are certain things like that happening, and it's very much in the media limelight. Yes. And you will also see certain organizations trying to promote certain ideologies, woke ideology, the LGBTQ agenda. I have absolutely nothing against the LGBTQ people. May they prosper, may they be happy. But trying to artificially bring in such ideologies where they typically would not exist, that's what they are trying to do. They will take one inch at a time, and you will see certain institutions, Indian institutions, that will promote this wokeism and these agendas, which may or may not be happening right now, right? So all of this is kind of intensifying after the advent of the great Mr. Garcetti to India, the new governor of the US, and it kind of coincides with certain statements of Mr. George Soros, who is the architect in chief of all kinds of disruptive activities worldwide and regime change operations. And he's the chief financier of many of these activities. So this is something that is part of the agenda to destabilize India and create more trouble in the run-up to the 2024 elections. Okay, the West does not want Prime Minister Modi to come back to power in 24. They very much would like to see a weak government, a pliable, malleable government to come to power so that they can turn India into a vassal state of theirs. Right now, India is standing firm. The Modi government has a very strong and very firm and very clear diplomatic and geopolitical stance that we are going to prioritize our national interest, everything else is subsidiary. So they don't want this. They don't like this. They want India to become a US vassal and accede to all the US demands. And that's why they would like to see the regime change in the 2024 general elections. So we are going to see an uptick in all of this. This is just the beginning. Manipur, we are seeing now. We're going to see much more. We're going to see more. You can rest assured that you're going to see more of this. So that is where we are right now. We are in the beginning of this phase. This is called outside external interference in your internal affairs. And that is something that certain nations excel at. Certain Western nations have perfected the art of doing this. Color revolutions, destabilizing nations. You know, the partition of India, the creation of Pakistan was the first color revolution. So this is something they have perfected, and this is something that we are seeing. So it's part, it may not appear to be this way, but it's part of a very much larger coordinated strategy. I mean, who is coordinating all these things? Somebody is. And that was the first thing I wanted to discuss. And there is something we're going to face more of in the coming months, in the run-up to the 2024 elections. Now let's talk about Papua New Guinea. Have you heard of Papua New Guinea? Let me bring that on the screen. First of all, we need a map because maps. Give me a second. Okay, we need a map to locate that country vis-a-vis India. Okay, let me put that on the screen. Here we are. So let's try and locate Papua New Guinea. We know where India is. Yes, we know that. So let's go eastwards from India. Let's go south and east. We know where Indonesia is, hopefully. This archipelago is called Indonesia. You go further east, and then you come to this nation called Papua New Guinea, which is north of Australia and east of Indonesia. Now, this is a nation that's full of jungles and forests. It's a reasonably large nation, and it's extremely rich in resources and minerals and, such things. So here's what happened. Serious breach of diplomatic protocols. Papua New Guinea strains ties with India by yielding to US bullying tactics. So let's try and see what happened. I'm going to actually read out this article so that you understand what's been happening. So after extensive negotiations over the last year, Papua New Guinea agreed to jointly host with India the third edition of the Forum of India Pacific Islands Cooperation, FIPIC Summit in Port Moresby between 21 and 23 May this year, which is this month itself. This included a high-level business delegation coming from India along with Prime Minister Narendra Modi to visit Papua New Guinea and undertake investments into key areas of oil and gas, pharmaceuticals, education, satellite and space industry, renewable energy projects like solar and hydroelectricity, defense cooperation, and agricultural sectors. A huge, wide-ranging a gamut of things that was supposed to happen. Now, Papua New Guinea, for unknown reasons, has agreed to allow the president of the US to gate crash this important FIPIC summit. This has resulted in the cancellation of the Indian business delegation's plan to visit Papua New Guinea. These actions by Papua New Guinea and the US are being perceived in India as a serious breach of established diplomatic protocols. It is pretty much resulting in the second-grade treatment being given by PNG to Prime Minister Modi, who is a democratically elected leader of the largest populated country in the world and has the third largest GDP in the world. So the US did not like the fact that India was entering into this large-scale in business and investment activity with this nation in so many diverse fields: oil and gas, pharmaceuticals, education, satellite and space industry, solar, hydroelectricity, defense cooperation, agriculture, all these things. So the US has decided to gate crash the party and kind of foil this entire initiative. The latest revelations are that the president of the US has instructed the prime ministers of Australia and New Zealand to attend the Pacific Islands Forum Summit in POM on 22nd May 23, when the president of the US will be in Papua New Guinea for only 3 hours. This effectively has changed what was meant to be a full-day FIPIC summit in Papua New Guinea between the Indian prime minister and the PIF leaders into only a 90-minute event. All this is because the PNG Prime Minister could not say no to the President of the US bulldozing his way for a meeting with PIF on the same day as the summit. And the Papua New Guinea Prime Minister decided to accommodate the US demands at the last minute. Well, the Papua New Guinea Prime Minister will have to accede to US demands. The US is the most powerful nation in the world. The Papua New Guinea Prime Minister has no option. So the fault of all this does not lie with Papua New Guinea. It is the fault of the US. They have decided to throw cold water on this entire initiative that India had taken. So nobody can understand the urgency of the gate crashing and bullying initiatives by the US in Papua New Guinea, especially considering his meeting other world leaders at the G7 summit in Japan a few days before 22nd May, and then Quad Leaders Summit in Sydney on 24 May, after which he will travel to the South Pacific nation countries to meet individually with the PIF leaders in their respective countries. So there was absolutely no need for the US president to come to Papua New Guinea, but he chose to come on the exact date that this summit is supposed to happen and the Indian Prime Minister is supposed to be there. So this is the deal. This will unfortunately reflect very poorly on Papua New Guinea as a country that's desperate to align with the West, but at the same time wants to grow its business with the fastest growing Asian economy of India. Also, the fact that PNG is a member of the non-aligned movement where India is a founding member reflects poorly, and so on. So this sequence of events reflects a fear among US and Western allies of the Indian Prime Minister's visit to Papua New Guinea for engaging with South Pacific region countries through an important FIPIC summit. It also reflects the importance of Prime Minister Modi in the current global climate that's got fast-moving geopolitical issues impacting humanity at large. The Chinese government will leverage these dramatic diplomatic changes and breaches of protocol to increase its footprint in an unstable South Pacific region. So the US is indirectly or maybe directly helping China and Mr. Xi Jinping at the expense of India. And yet it claims that it is on India's side. Isn't it strange? So this is the situation. This is the situation, right? Papua New Guinea, this nation, had the chance to partner with India and grow its own economy and economic ties, and in the sectors of LNG, liquefied natural gas, agriculture, fisheries, forestry, petrochemicals, resources exports, and so trade that could be worth billions of dollars within a few years. That opportunity essentially is gone. So the US has derailed this entire initiative. And yet they claim that they are India's allies and they have India's best interests in mind. They have derailed this initiative by India. They have caused immense harm to this very poor nation of Papua New Guinea. And they have ended up helping China. This is what the US is doing, right? And then, so we don't know what's going to happen now. Will Prime Minister Modi go ahead and visit Papua New Guinea, or will the entire matter be, you know, shelved? So right now, this report that I am reading over here was from May 3, which is like 3 days before today. And this is an older report which says that Prime Minister Modi and Biden will meet in Papua New Guinea next month. Well, I don't know if it will happen or not. So this is the situation. The PNG Prime Minister is saying avoid unnecessary comments on Modi and Biden. Well, that's the situation. So the US has interfered. We know that the US is trying to interfere in the internal affairs of India. And now we are seeing that it's interfering diplomatically in the bilateral and multilateral relationship that India is trying to build with the Pacific Island nations. It is directly interfering and coming in the way. Right? So these are not the actions of a friendly state. The US is trying to hamper India's rise and India's diplomatic outreach to other nations. So what could be the purpose behind this? I think these US bullying tactics indicate that the US is worried about India's rise. It is now beginning to perceive India as a genuine and serious long-term competitor, economic competitor, and diplomatic competitor, geopolitical competitor, and maybe in the long term even a military competitor. That's how the US sees India right now. And they are trying to nip India's rise in the bud by doing all these things. They are interfering in the internal matters of India. They are trying to destabilize India, hopefully, from their perspective, bring about a regime change in 24. And also, they are trying to hamper India's diplomatic outreach to other nations. So So this is something that I don't see the media really focusing on much. So that's why I thought that I should speak about this, because it is a very important matter. And it comes from a nation that calls itself India, or, you know, India's biggest ally. It wants India to ally with it and align with it. And it talks about democracy and human rights and the rules-based world order and the freedom of navigation and whatnot. And look at their behavior. Look at what they're actually doing. So, yeah, this is something that the U.S. is up to. Okay, now let's talk about Ukraine. It's been a while since we spoke about Ukraine. What's happening in Ukraine? So, well, overall, if you look at the situation on the map, it's pretty much stable. There's not much advancement happening on either, from either side, from the Ukrainians or the Russians. The Ukrainians and various geopolitical commentators, analysts, etc., they have been saying for months that a Ukrainian offensive is coming. Well, if you're going to conduct an offensive, you don't announce the offensive. You got to keep it secret. What's the point of an offensive which is announced months in advance? You know, in warfare, surprise is the key element. And this is something they are telegraphing months in advance. So it's very strange, very fishy, very weird. Anyhow, right now, there's not much happening. There is fighting happening in Bakhmut and other places. There are Russian missile strikes happening on Ukraine on a reasonably regular basis. The Ukrainians claim that they are, you know, gathering for an offensive. Let's see what happens about that. But what's been in the news of late is this. It's been an attempted drone strike on the Kremlin, on Putin's residence. So this is a video which shows a drone coming down, swooping down on Mr. Putin's residence and exploding, but not causing any damage. And apparently there were two drones. So that's what we hear. And this is from RT.com, which is the Russian official, broadcaster. So it's a genuine account. It's something that comes from the Russians themselves. So that was a big news just a couple of days ago. This is from May 3. It's from 3 days ago. So what do we make of this is the question. A drone strike on Putin's residence. It was not successful, clearly, as we saw in the video. But what does it indicate? So what are the possibilities? The one possibility is that this drone was launched from outside of Russia and it came all the way up to Moscow. Where is the map? We need to bring the map in. Just give me a second. Map. Give me a second. I'll have to open a map. To understand the distance between Ukraine and Russia, we need to look at the map, for which I need to pull it up. Here we are. Let me pull this up. And bring it here. Let me put the globe view on. All right. So Ukraine and Moscow. If you look at the closest point on the Ukraine border to Moscow and we measure the distance, it's about 450 kilometers in a straight line. So if this drone was launched from outside of Russia, it would have flown at least 450 kilometers. Now, you can obviously make a drone fly as low as possible so as to evade radar. And yet it's an immense, massive, huge security lapse if this drone was launched from outside Russia, that the Russians could not detect it at all and it was able to breach all their security perimeters and come not only into inside Moscow, but, you know, explode right on top of Mr. Putin's residence. That's a massive security lapse. So that is if it was launched from outside of Russia. Another possibility is that this drone was launched from within Russia itself, which means that they have been able to infiltrate personnel and equipment within Russia, which again is a huge security lapse. So it's either Ukrainians who have come in within Russian territory, or maybe it is Russians who are working on behalf of Ukraine, you know, which would typically be termed as traitors. So once again, even if that is the case, even if the drone was launched from within Russia, even then it is a huge security lapse. So this is option two. Possibility one is it was launched from outside Russia. That's a huge security lapse. Option two, possibility two is that it was launched from within Russia, which is also a huge security lapse. The third option is that this was a false flag operation. What is a false flag operation? A false flag operation is like what happened recently when the Ukrainians shot down their own drone and then claimed that it came from Russia, then claimed it was a Russian drone, which means that you attack yourself and then shoot down the attacker and then claim that the attack happened from somewhere else. It's kind of like a few months ago, there was a missile strike in Poland or somewhere that the Ukrainians did, and they tried to, when the G20 summit was happening in Bali, at the time the Ukrainians did a missile strike on a neighboring nation, and then they tried to blame it on the Russians, and they tried to set off World War III. So that's a false flag operation. So the third possibility is that this drone strike was a false flag operation, which would mean that the Russians themselves launched the drone and they made it look like it was a Ukrainian drone, which did not succeed. And then they will use this as the pretext to attack Ukraine at the time of their choosing. So that is also a possibility. So there are three possibilities. It was launched from outside Russia by the Ukrainians. It was launched from within Russia by the Ukrainians. Or it was a false flag operation. These are the three possibilities that I can see. Now, which possibility is most likely? I don't quite know. I think it's quite unlikely that there could be such a monumental security lapse. This could possibly, I mean, if the drone had exploded or struck the building, it could possibly have killed President Vladimir Putin. So this, if it is really the case, that's a monumental security lapse. I think it's quite unlikely that such a security lapse of that magnitude could happen. I think it's extremely unlikely. So that would raise the possibility that this could perhaps have been a false flag attack. That's a possibility. So now, do I have evidence of that or no or not? I don't have any evidence. I'm just trying to see the logic. So what, from, if you look at the probabilities, which probability is most likely? I think the probability of a false flag operation seems to be slightly higher than the first and second possibilities. And yet we don't quite know what happened and what the truth is. But the Russians have said that this was a Ukrainian attack on the residence of Vladimir Putin. And they have said that they will retaliate at a time and a place of their choosing. That's the deal. Right, so that is one thing that's happening. Now let's take a look at this. The Wagner Group announces that it will leave Bakhmut. So where is Bakhmut? Bakhmut is somewhere in the east, southeast of Ukraine. Well, it will take me some time to locate it. So let me just Google it. Let me just search for it. Yeah, here it is, Bakhmut. So Bakhmut is this massive fight, this massive battle that's been happening for several months between the Wagner Group, which is a Russian paramilitary group, which is led by Yevgeny Prigozhin and the Ukrainian armed forces. And it's been referred to as the Bakhmut meat grinder. Horrible name, but that essentially is what is happening there. So the Wagner Group has announced that it will leave Bakhmut. Yevgeny Prigozhin, the founder of the Russian paramilitary outfit of the Wagner Group, announced on Friday that his fighters will leave the city of Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine on May 10 due to a shortage of ammunition. So he claims that there is a shortage of ammunition. His fighters are not being given sufficient ammunition, which is causing the deaths of many of his fighters, and that's why he has decided to withdraw from Bakhmut, leave Bakhmut. And once again, this is the same story from the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation. They will pull the fighters out of Bakhmut on May 10 because of ammunition shortages. He said that tens of thousands had been killed and injured there. And he blamed Shoigu, Sergei Shoigu. I think he blamed Shoigu for that. So that's what's happened. And now Putin ally vows to send troops to Bakhmut to replace Wagner's forces. Which ally? The Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov. He said on Friday that he would send troops to fight in Bakhmut if the Wagner group pulls out of the Ukrainian city. Ramzan Kadyrov said that. So that's the situation. Now, what really is happening is the question, right? So one possibility, once again, I'm looking at the different possibilities. One possibility is that the Russians will withdraw, which will be a tactical withdrawal. They will allow the Ukrainians to come into Bakhmut and then they will spring a surprise on them. And then it could be, you know, a trap for the Ukrainians. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the Wagner group may have done its job and now it is time for it to withdraw. And maybe what Prigozhin is saying is right. So that is the situation. We will have to see and await the developments and see what happens. As you can see, Ukraine is a massively large country, very flat country. So that's the deal with Bakhmut. It's cost the lives of I don't even know how many Ukrainian soldiers, Ukrainian armed forces personnel who have been thrown into the meat grinder. But now the Wagner group is withdrawing and maybe the Chechens will move in. The Chechens are always up for a fight. So that's the deal. So that is another story that was of note. Apart from that, there's not a lot happening right now. I mean, a lot of activity or movement. There's one more piece of news, which is this. Russian ground forces bigger today than at the start of the war in Ukraine, which is what a US general has said. This is a report from April 27, which is about a week or so ago, maybe 10 days ago. So while Russia has suffered thousands of losses in its war against Ukraine, a senior US military commander in Europe told lawmakers on Wednesday that they have plenty more firepower left in their arsenal. The Russian ground force is bigger today than it was at the beginning of the conflict. That's what General Christopher Cavoli, commander of the US European Command, said. The Russian Air Force has lost very little. They've lost about 80 planes. They have another 1,000 fighters and fighter bombers. And the Navy has lost one ship, which was the Moskva. So that is the deal. The Russians are, you know, doing well. This is a different news outlet reporting the same story. U.S. general cautions against writing Russia's army off in Ukraine. It's bigger today than it was at the beginning of the conflict. Right? So that is the deal. That is what is happening vis-a-vis Russia. The other strange thing which happened was that the Ukrainians took a jibe at India for some reason. And the jibe was this. One of the Twitter accounts, Defense of Ukraine, Defense U, put out this strange caricature, mocking and disrespectful caricature of the goddess Kali. The goddess Kali, as all Indians will know, is the goddess of destruction. And these Ukrainians, they tried mocking the goddess of destruction. Right? And it's strange that the same Twitter account, Defense U, in 2018 had posted this about Volodymyr Zelensky. This naked clown, Volodymyr Zelensky, is dreaming of becoming the president of Ukraine. If this American stooge, who knows nothing about foreign and defense policy, succeeds in his plan, he will destroy our nation with the help of NATO. Don't vote for this guy. Well, that's precisely what's happened, isn't it? So the same Twitter account which had tweeted this in 2018 before the election of Mr. Zelensky to power, his ascent to power, is now tweeting something like this. And we know how the Ukrainians treated Indian students when the war broke out. Tremendous display of racism, not only against Indians, but also against Africans and Pakistanis and Turks. Very xenophobic people. And we know their Nazi proclivities as well. So yeah, it's very strange that they chose to mock the goddess of destruction when their nation is facing impending destruction. So what's the deal with Ukraine? We still don't know which direction this war is going to take. It's very hard to predict. As the Americans themselves tell us, the Russian armed forces are now larger than what they were when the war began, because the Russians have been recruiting more soldiers, bringing in more reserves, and their air force is essentially intact. They have more than 1,000 aircraft at their disposal right now, and they've lost one warship, the Moskva. So the Russian economy is fine. The Russian ruble is doing more or less fine. Sanctions have not really worked. The sanctions are hurting Europe more than Russia. And so that's the situation. The Russian armed forces are in good shape, and better shape perhaps. So that is the situation right now vis-a-vis the war with Ukraine. The Russians, for whatever reason, are not advancing right now. So what is the end game for Mr. Putin? What does he want? We don't quite know. Will this become a stalemate which will go on for several years? Will this be a slow war that is designed to essentially sap away the vitality in the people of Ukraine? Will Ukraine become another Korea-like nation, divided into North and South or East and West, that sort of thing, like East Germany, West Germany, or North Korea, South Korea? Or is there an offensive coming at some point in time from the Russians or from the Ukrainians? We still don't know. It's almost impossible to predict what could happen, because, well, the best plans are those that are the most invisible and the ones that are kept secret the best. So that is about Ukraine. Strange things happening in Ukraine, especially from the UK, Ukraine government. They're taking jibes at India. What sense does it make? I simply don't understand. So later the Twitter account deleted the text, that image, the tweet, but did not issue any apology. And I think Ukraine's deputy vice foreign minister expressed some form of regret or whatever, but did not apologize. So yeah, okay, good for them, Ukraine. I personally, well, Ukraine seems to be another temporary nation now. Yeah, that is the situation. Okay, let's move on to France. What's happening between France and India? Let's take a look at this. So the French embassy in India has tweeted this recently. Prime Minister Modi will be the guest of honor at France's Bastille Day celebrations on the 14th of July. What does it mean? So let's not play the video. So 14th of July is France's national day. It's called the Bastille Day. The Bastille was this fortress that was destroyed in the late 18th century, I think 1789, I think. It is in Paris. It was in Paris. Now there is nothing there. It's called the Place de la Bastille. It's a park kind of thing, or a memorial. It's about 6 kilometers from the Champs-Élysées, the Arc de Triomphe. 14th of July is France's national day. It dates back to the French Revolution. The French celebrate what binds them together, the values of égalité, liberté, fraternité, which is also part of the preamble of India's constitution. Every Bastille Day, Paris's famous Avenue de Champs-Élysées hosts a military parade, not very different from India's Republic Day parade on Kartavya Path. France has been the Republic Day guest of honor 5 times since 1951. Prime Minister Modi will be the second Indian Prime Minister to be the guest of honor on Bastille Day after Dr. Manmohan Singh in 2009. Sorry. 25 years of strategic partnership between India and France is being celebrated this year. Indian and French troops will march side by side in the military parade in Paris. Such images speak louder than words about how close India and France are. And so on. There is geopolitical significance. India and France have stood together since 1947, good and bad times, which is kind of true, actually. Yeah. From defense in the Indo-Pacific, from space to climate and more, we work together, fostering strategic autonomy in all areas and promoting a more just, rules-based world order, and so on. So yeah, we are together in this for the long run. And Monsieur Macron also tweeted about this in French and in Hindi, saying that I'm very happy to welcome you in Paris as the guest of honor of the 14th of July event. That's what he is saying over here. So this, so Monsieur Macron recently had visited China, which was kind of a disaster for him. You know, he did not quite succeed in swaying President Xi Jinping towards his, and make President Xi accept what he wanted him to do, like, you know, convince Mr. Putin to end the war and all that stuff. Mr. Xi showed a lot of impatience when all that was brought up. And yeah, so the visit of Monsieur Macron to China did not have very good optics, and it is more or less seen, especially by the West, as an unsuccessful trip and kind of a disastrous trip. So now it is possibly time for Monsieur Macron to make up for that and have a successful visit of the Prime Minister of India to France and regain, you know, improve his image a little bit and get some good work done. So India and France obviously have a very good relationship. France is the only nation in NATO and in the EU which has a quasi-independent foreign policy, like I've said many times. It's not entirely a US vassal. It is kind of independent to some extent from US influence and interference, especially in the military domain. And the US has been, you know, doing certain things that the French are very unhappy about, like the AUKUS submarine deal, which essentially the US forced Australia to turn its back on a deal they had already signed with France. So there's a lot of heartburn in France about that. So that's a good opportunity for France to work with India and maybe pay them back, and pay the Australians and the Anglo-Saxon grouping back in some form, you know. So that's the deal. So this is a good sign for India-France relations. France is a good strategic partner for India, not only in Europe but also in the Indian Ocean region, where France has significant holdings in the form of several islands and possessions. So that's an interesting development that's about to happen on 14th of July. Okay. So now there is a more concerning development that we are seeing. And let me put that on the screen. This is of concern to us. China, this is a report from May 3. That's 3 days ago. China is keen to recruit Gurkha soldiers into the People's Liberation Army. Will it become the third country after the UK and India to hire the fearless Gurkha men? And more concerning is this. Not a single Nepalese Gurkha will be joining the Indian Army in 2023. The communist government of Nepal has decided not to allow the 1,300-odd Gurkhas who join the Indian Army annually to be recruited. The predicament has been the newly launched 4-year service Agnipath scheme of the Indian Army, which is a pretext for the communist government in Nepal to prevent the Gurkhas from joining the Indian Army. Another chilling effect could be waiting in the already frosty Indo-Nepalese ties. Communist China, which has long been intrigued by the motivation behind Nepalese youth joining the Indian Army, may seek the communist government in Nepal to allow Gurkhas to join the People's Liberation Army. This is an apparent attempt by China, under which the Mao Zedong plan wanted to gobble up Nepal as one of its 5 fingers of occupied Tibet, to exploit the communist government in Nepal to create an anti-India sentiment in the Himalayan region. So the Chinese want to recruit possibly Gurkhas into the People's Liberation Army. The question is, even if the communist government in Nepal is willing to go along with this plan, the question is, will the Gurkhas want to join the Chinese army? That's the question. Now, obviously, there are economic reasons for wanting to join the army of another nation. When it comes to India, well, we are the same people, India and Nepal. We're the same culture, the same heritage, all that. So it's not that much of a big deal. you know, you go to Nepal, you don't really feel like you're outside India. And Nepalese, when they come to India, they don't really feel like they're in a foreign country. It's this, you know. So for the Gorkhas to join the Indian army is not, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. They're fighting for their own people. So that is not very peculiar or strange, but there are financial incentives for and reasons for the Gorkhas to join the British army. For instance, we have this gentleman, Nirmal Purja, who is possibly the greatest mountaineer of all time. He is also known as Nims Dai. So he is a Gorkha. He is a Nepal-born, naturalized British mountaineer and holder of multiple mountaineering world records. Prior to becoming a mountaineer, he served in the British Army with the Brigade of the Gorkhas, followed by the Special Boat Service, the Special Forces Unit of the Royal Navy. So, there's a huge financial incentive for Gorkhas to join the Gorkha Brigade, the Brigade of Gorkhas, in the British Army. You get to eventually, hopefully, perhaps become a British citizen, right? It's a whole different way of life, quality of life. Most Gorkhas who live in Nepal live in some amount of poverty. Yeah? And for them, becoming a soldier is just a means of getting out of poverty, especially if you can pass the fitness tests and all that and become part of the British Gorkha Brigade. Then you can take your family out of Nepal and settle down in the UK and perhaps eventually get British citizenship. So when it comes to the British army, the Gorkhas, they do that for the sake of better life and as a means of getting out of poverty. When they join the Indian army, I don't think it's that much about the money. It's about being a soldier and you know, that sort of thing. Now, when it comes to the Chinese army, let's say the Nepalese government allows the Gorkhas or asks the Gorkhas to join the People's Liberation Army, what would be the incentive to join the PLA? Will there be a financial incentive? Will the PLA pay them well? I am sure the PLA can pay them very well for sure. But what about the quality of life? Will the Nepalese Gorkhas want to go and settle down in China and become Chinese citizens? Or will they not see the Chinese as aggressors? I think everyone knows what the Chinese have done in Tibet. And the fact that the Chinese have also been encroaching on significant amounts of Nepalese territory, I'm sure the government of Nepal will try to hide that. But that has indeed happened. The Chinese are in the process of actively encroaching on Nepalese territory. Be that as it may, this is a very concerning development, especially when it comes to India. India kind of, you know, the situation in Nepal is not very good from India's perspective. There is a communist government in power, a pro-Beijing government in power. Nepalese politics in the past 20, 30 years has become more and more anti-India. As long as the royal family was there in power in Nepal, Nepal was a very pro-India nation. But the Indian government in the 1990s ensured that the Nepalese royal family was thrown out of power and a Maoist insurgency was allowed to succeed, after which the politics in Nepal has become more and more pro-China, pro-communist, and anti-India. So the situation in Nepal is very concerning when it comes to India. It could possibly offer the Chinese a foothold in the Indian subcontinent. And if the Gorkhas start joining the Chinese People's Liberation Army, it could end up becoming a very significant security threat for India. So how does the Indian government deal with it? I think I will leave it to the Indian government to decide what to do about this. But yes, this is something that is of special and significant concern for India. Yeah, not very good news when it comes to this. Right, now what else has been happening in diplomacy, etc.? We had the SCO summit, the Shanghai Cooperation Agreement, organization. SCO is a Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in which various nations, including Pakistan, participated. So Dr. Jaishankar has tweeted about this, hosted colleagues in Goa for the meeting of the SCO Council for Foreign Ministers. Long tweet. Now we can tweet long. And some very interesting images have been shared. The new Chinese foreign minister on his first visit to India as foreign minister, and the foreign ministers of various other nations, including Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, also there. Mr. Bhutto Zardari of Pakistan. Other images have also been shared over here, etc. And what's interesting is that Dr. Jaishankar did not shake hands with any of the foreign ministers. He greeted them all with a namaste. And many of them did namaste back. The Chinese foreign minister did hit the Chinese namaste, which is a fist and the palm put together. But yeah, interesting piece of diplomacy. And Mr. Zardari, Bhutto Zardari, whatever he is, he also did namaste. And yeah, you can see the expressions which speak for themselves. And Mr. Bhutto Zardari, Bilawal ji, he showed a bit of immaturity in his behavior at the statements that he made to the press, especially the Pakistani press. And yeah, it was kind of embarrassing for Pakistan. I mean, if you were a Pakistani, you would certainly be embarrassed about how things went for their delegation. Right, we are almost at the end for today. One more thing has happened today itself. And what is that one more thing that's happened today? Let's put that on the screen. Ah, here we are. Britain has a new king. Oh, sorry, not this image. This here we are. This is the right image. King Charles, the king of Great Britain, Northern Ireland, and the Commonwealth realms, His Majesty Charles III is anointed to reign. Commonwealth realms. Is India part of the Commonwealth? India is part of the Commonwealth. Is India part of the Commonwealth realms? I'm not sure what the technical terms are, but India is certainly part of the Commonwealth. And if they mean the Commonwealth, are they claiming that he's the king of all the Commonwealth nations as well? This needs to be investigated. He certainly is not the king of India. I can assure them all of that. Unless there are some special secret clauses somewhere that we are not aware of. Some people allege that, right? And this is a report from the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, about the coronation of King Charles and Queen Consort Camilla. Let us enlarge this image and see what this lady Camilla is wearing. She's wearing a crown, which is... And you can see there is a certain jewel on the crown in the front, which happens to be India's Kohinoor diamond. So they will never stop showcasing their loot, what they've looted from India. A nation of bandits, that's what they are, and that's what they're showcasing. So anyhow, that's something that happened today. Good for the British. Long live their king and whatever else, yeah. So that's another interesting event that happened today. So they claim that he is the king of the Commonwealth realms. Are they implicitly claiming that he is also the king of India? Very strange. Anyhow, that's not really important, because the UK is no longer an important country. It's no longer a first-rate world power. It's not even a second-rate world power. The UK is a third-rate world power. It is a vassal state of the US. And this king, well, he's a very wealthy king for sure. Charles is a very, very wealthy king, and his wealth is much more than you think it is. He owns entire nations for sure. I'm not sure about India, but he does certainly own other nations in their entirety, possibly including Canada and Australia, all the land. Yeah. So yeah, that's about the new king of England. So that's what's been happening in recent times. We took a break from the Indian interest. We're going to resume it now. But for today, we are at the end of today's session. So once again, let me come back to the main focus of this episode, which was the beginning of the external interference in India's internal affairs. It's only going to intensify. We are witnessing what's happening in Manipur. We are witnessing other protests happening in India. This is, I fear, just the beginning. The Indian government will definitely be very cognizant of what could be brewing. We have intelligence services that keep an eye on things before they actually happen. But yeah, there are certain very powerful nations that would like to see India destabilized in the run-up to the 2024 elections. So we could see a lot more of that coming up in the coming months. I hope it doesn't happen. I don't wish it to happen, but it is possible that this could happen. And we need to anticipate that and be prepared for that. So yeah, we're going to keep an eye on these matters, on these matters in future episodes. So that brings me to the end of today's episode. Thank you very much for watching, and I will see you very soon in the next live stream. Thank you. Take care and keep raising your standards as always. Thank you.